Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, Ken Cotto for Mr. Zebvi, the appellant. We're last on the docket, so I'm not too sure how that goes.
Oh, it doesn't. It's just like any other case. But would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
2 minutes, please. Mr. Zebdi has raised this appeal. He thought about it before he did it. I wish I could tell you the reason why, but it's not on the record, and so I won't even go there. What I'd like to focus on today is not so much on the sale of the Odyssey, but more particularly on the award of attorney fees below. There were $30,000 awarded.
For a better understanding of what the assignment of error is, mm-hmm. On the award of the $16,000 for the sale of the Odyssey, my understanding from reading the briefs is that the argument is that the court erred in making the finding in the decree that that sale violated the October temporary restraining order.
That's correct.
Is there a challenge to the trial court's decision to award the $16,000 as a disproportionate award of the assets?
I'm not making that.
Okay, thank you. That was my point of clarity.
No, I'm not making that, nor is Mr. Zebdi. In fact, that particular assignment of error, one of these things when I'm the lawyer and I'm retained, hey, this happened 2 weeks before that order. So raise it. So I raise it because I certainly don't want a bar complaint. Those are not good.
Okay. That was my point of clarification. Thank you. So you now want to address the attorney's fees.
No, but as is my obligation as his lawyer, I also have to tell you that there was the September restraining order.
Oh, I know
that. That did do that.
No, absolutely.
And so
we're aware of that. There were two restraining orders.
I thought so.
Okay, but thank you.
Mr. Zebdi got stuck for $30,000 in attorney fees at the end of the trial. Half of it under 2609-140, and half of it under CR 11 and for his intransigence. As far as 2609-140 goes, at the time the action was filed, Mr. Zebdi was working. He had a company, still does, doesn't make any money at it. Judge Ramsdell said, at the time this thing was filed, you had the ability to pay Ms. Goma, Dr. Goma actually, because she has her PhD in psychology, has the need. Judge Ramsdell said, you don't, either of you, have the ability to pay anything at the end of the trial. They're pretty much both impecunious, Mr. Zebdi having lost his job about 3 weeks before trial. He's still unemployed, by the way, so it wasn't a temporary thing. But it's not something I could assign error to because he thought it was going to be temporary, and he wishes it was temporary, but it isn't. The judge relied on the first Friedlander case. That case doesn't stand for the proposition that you award attorney fees at the time of filing. All that case says is that in this convoluted mess that was in the Friedlander's property situation, her lawyers had to go look prior to filing to see what was there and doing their due diligence. It didn't say anything about fees being awarded at the time of the filing as the standard. Stedman.
So are you arguing that the court ignored the fact that Mr. Zebdi was unemployed?
He passed and said, I'm considering this a temporary occurrence. He said that actually more towards maintenance, but obviously it goes towards his ability to pay attorney fees because he clearly made the finding and he found orally as well that neither had the ability to pay anything at the time of trial. Stedman says in footnote, I always kind of wondered about footnotes and opinions. If it's important enough to say it ought to be in the opinion and not in the footnote, but it's the footnote that at least gives us a hint as to when you are supposed to be looking at this ability to pay and the need. And it is at the time they're requested. And I think you can kind of figure that out by our own rules and the RAPs that you're supposed to do this affidavit of financial aid or at least some financial statement 10 days before the hearing. Well, if it was important way back when, why is it important now? Because it's the present need and the present ability to pay, and he doesn't have it.
Was there any dispute, and I suppose I should say, was there any finding on the question, if it was raised, as to whether his unemployment was voluntary or involuntary?
I don't think it was raised. His unemployment did run out, though, last month, and that's in his statement that was filed.
But it wasn't part of the litigation that he had become intentionally less well off.
No, he wanted
the trial approached.
Here's an Algerian guy in the middle of the desert, and he's got a fisheries master's. He was trying to get his PhD and apparently did not do well. And so he didn't get it. However, Ms. Goma did. CR 11. If you're going to hack somebody with CR 11 sanctions, you'd better say the reasons why, and you just don't give lip service to the consideration of the factors. And nothing was done in this case as far as why CR 11 goes. As far as intransigence goes, it's embodied in a bunch of emails between counsel and Mr. Zebdi. They did not have the most smooth relationship. And whether that translates to CR 11 and intransigence, it doesn't. It's just there were
and
reasons.
The emails you're referencing were between whom? Mr. Zebdi and who?
Counsel. Counsel for Ms. Goma. So there's nothing in the record to support that 50%. As far as the domestic violence goes, if I were the trial judge, as far as anything going against Ms. Goma, I would have also made the finding that, yes, there was a history of abuse, domestic violence. But I'm not the judge doing that. And as far as Mr. Zebdi is concerned, it's not so much with Ms. Goma, what's happened there, but it's with the children. He wants to be involved, and there is no, even assuming there was domestic violence with the two boys, because Miriam, the daughter, is not involved in this, there is still a question as to whether that lack of present danger says he doesn't have to go through DV dads and domestic violence treatment. I think I'll just go on.
Okay, you had, I think, two.
2 minutes. Yeah. Okay. There's these three phases of training, apparently. The play years, nothing happened in the play years.
So this is in the Islamic religion.
Yeah. 7 to 14. This is where everything happened. This is where you have the training years. The training, I wouldn't call it training. I wouldn't raise my kids that way, but I've seen it. I've seen it in Japanese culture, for Pete's sake. But although it may not be the way I would raise my children, there is an explanation for it under Islamic and North African culture.
But isn't your argument that the court did not take into consideration the cultural factors that you're describing now?
Yes, it's rather like the need and the ability to pay. It's lip service, but nothing was really considered. And if you look over here at the public report of Ms. Ballantyne, the GAL, mm-hmm. nothing is mentioned about that. If you look at the sealed report, nothing is mentioned about domestic violence. It is interesting to note that Exhibit 49, the so-called interim report, mm-hmm. Mr. Zebdi nor Mr. Weston did not receive that report. I have the reports they received. It wasn't that one.
Well, that was admitted as an exhibit at
trial.
Yes,
it was, and that's when they first saw it. And even though these are, it's in the record, there is some consideration of cultural factors. It'd be like me trying to tell you what Islam teaches. And it's just generalizations that have nothing to do with anything. And perhaps that's why it never shows up in her reports afterwards. And I don't have any time left, and I don't have any rebuttal. So
okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Margaret Fitzpatrick. I represent the respondent, Hannah Goma, in this divorce case. We are asking the court to affirm the trial court's decision below and also to grant additional attorney fees to the wife based upon the present financial circumstances, her need, and what we perceive as Mr. Zebdi's ability to pay. I'll go straight to the attorney fees issue. The court has inquired, when do we look at the ability to pay? When do we look at the need? The divorce cases are happening pretty much within a year or a little more. Things can change throughout that time period. When the case was initiated, Mr. Zebdi incurred over $30,000 worth of attorney fees. He liquidated the community assets, borrowed money, paid money to counsel of his choosing, and he was vigorously litigating this every way that he could. In our in response to the motion for temporary orders, we asked for attorney fees of $10,000. It was obvious that this case was going to spin out of control, even at that time. And we did not get attorney fees. But there was clearly a need, and that was probably the time during which Mr. Zebdi had the most ability to pay based upon the objective evidence that was before the court. Now, up until about a couple of weeks before trial, we litigated with Mr. Zebdi, often pro se. He would not cooperate with anything. We couldn't get the confirmation of issues signed. He wouldn't answer the interrogatories. He just wasn't not going to do it because he didn't view that was appropriate. Everything about this case was how Mr. Zebdi viewed the world and how to raise the children, whether or not his actions were domestic violence, whether or not he had the financial ability to pay, whether or not I had the right to ask him for financial information. He wasn't going to give it to me. It was none of my business.
Is this the intransigence argument?
That's part of it. That's part of it, yes.
Mm-hmm. Back to your original point, though, about when do we look at it.
Well, when do you look at it?
When you get to the end of a case, you wouldn't say, well, when this started off, there was a huge need, but in the meantime, someone won the lottery, but we're going to award fees based on how it started, right?
No,
you'd look
no.
at it how it ends, right?
No. My client's position did not... Well, it did improve a little bit in that she was able to get a job, a lower-paying job. Mr. Zebdi continued his employment until just a couple of weeks before trial. We were not told until right at trial that he was unemployed. We never had an opportunity to do any type of investigation as to what happened. We had no idea what had happened. He did not provide even a financial declaration that was up to date at the time of trial. The one that's in the record is one that I pulled out and put in from the previous temporary motions. We had no information. He had a consulting business. Even today, we don't have any information. We have no documentation. He submitted a declaration. He's got an unsupported financial declaration. Well, I'm unemployed. We don't have any bank records. We don't have any tax returns. We don't have anything. He also, it came out very clearly in trial, he had the ability to obtain loans from his friends at no interest rate. He had a lot of friends he was teaching at the mosque. They were very supportive of him. My client had nothing. He even sold the car out for her. She had no transportation, no nothing. The fact that somebody loses their job right before trial, does that mean that the trial court should find, well, they don't have the ability to pay anything? They can't pay attorney fees. They can't pay maintenance. Is that reasonable? I think you've got to look at the totality of circumstances, what has happened, what the situation was. He had a very long history of regular employment. My client had none. He was always in control of the money. He went in initially and started handling the money the way that he wanted to. My client wasn't even aware what they had. He kept her in the dark.
I asked the question to counsel, but what you do is you impute income if you find that it's a voluntary situation. Mm-hmm. Did that happen here?
I'm hesitating because I don't know that the court had to impute some income to him, and I'm thinking about the child support order, and I honestly cannot tell you. Well. But he assumed that Mr. Zebdi would be reemployed fairly quickly. Also, Mr. Zebdi testified that he had applied for unemployment, but he didn't know how much money he was going to get. So we had no information.
Was a child support order entered.
Yes, there was.
And so the court did make a determination as to income.
Yes, I think that's about the only, yeah.
And the court did, I believe, impute income to Mr. Zebdi.
Did he? Okay. But I think the situation was,
Don't we look at that and see whether or not that supports the finding of ability to pay? We've got a lot of talk about the difficulties in the case, but in autopsying the case, so to speak, what we do, it seems if there's a finding on a question, even if it's applied to a different issue, don't we just import that finding, look and see what it tells us and see if it supports the other ruling?
And I do think that that would be very good evidence upon which to rely upon. The court did make a finding as to what his income capabilities are and applied the child support schedules and set the child support. However, the court was not comfortable with going forward and saying, when you're an imputing income situation, that he's got the ability to pay maintenance. I mean, the court was not willing to go that far.
Well, that's why the court awarded the $16,000 from the Honda.
Right, a disparate property division. Right, right. And then the court did award attorney fees based upon my client's need and the court's view of Mr. Zebdi's ability to pay at that time. And I think that that was based on the historical data that we were able to present with that he had money that she was not aware of.
Now, what about intransigence?
Yes.
So the argument is that the court improperly simply relied on your declaration. Are there findings that are separate and apart from your declaration that support the court's intransigence?
Well, I think that there are. If you look at the court record, the motions that we filed, the things that we had to do.
The court's findings.
Well, there was an order that I had to go to court because he wouldn't sign the confirmation of issues. That was one of the orders that was in evidence.
Again, the question is back to us autopsying the decision.
Right.
In the decision, now we've located somewhere we can go that's a finding as to his income that we can look and decide it either does or does not support ability to pay on attorney's fees. So then the question is, with regard to the intransigence finding, not is there evidence in the record that would support it, but is there a finding that details what the judge believed?
I don't know if it was it's specifically characterized as a finding, but in the findings of fact and conclusions of law, the court does recite, and in the oral decision, does recite a lot of the actions taken by Mr. Zebdi that at every turn caused an increase in her fees, a refusal to answer interrogatories, refusal to provide information, noting hearings when I was not available. There was an ongoing pattern.
Was the oral decision transcribed?
Yes, it's in the record.
I'll be able to see that.
Yes, okay. And I did cite it in my argument. Yes. So with that, I would just ask you to affirm the lower court's ruling in all respects, and I do feel compelled to again ask for attorney's fees because I always do, and I ask for attorney fees from you folks as well, from Ms. Goma.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That concludes the calendar today.